According to our next guest, an unprecedented redistribution of jobs, population, and wealth is underway in America, and it's likely to accelerate, or accelerate, as we say in the States, in the years to come. America's new economic map shows growing differences, not just between people, but especially between communities. In the new book, The New Geography of Jobs, UC Berkeley economist Enrico Moretti looks to provide perspective on the tectonic shifts that are reshaping America's labor market, from globalization and income and inequality to immigration and technological progress, and how these shifts are affecting our communities. Drawing on a wealth of stimulating new studies, Moretti uncovers what smart policies may be appropriate to address the social challenges that are arising. And we welcome Enrico Moretti to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate you here sharing the work.
Good morning.
Good morning. What got you thinking about the question, is where you live hindering your career?
Well, I've been working as an academic economist for 15 years on the issue of why some cities are so successful and other cities are not particularly successful at creating jobs and giving people good wages. And then I finally decided to write a book for not just a technical paper, but a book for the general public.
So how much of it is the policies and the place of the city, and how much of it has to do with the actual geography, East Coast, West Coast, the access to water, whatever the case may be?
A lot of it has to do with geography, but it's not about access to water or access to natural resources. It's actually access to educated workers. If you look at the map of America today, you see three increasingly different countries. On one end, there are cities like San Francisco, Seattle, Austin, Raleigh, or Boston, New York, or D.C., with a highly educated, highly creative and innovative labor force that is one of the best paid in America. At the other extreme, there are cities like Flint or Detroit or Cleveland, which have been struggling and are losing population. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country that seems almost undecided on which direction to take. And what's interesting is that in the 1980s, the difference between these three Americas was small. Sure, you had more prosperous cities and less prosperous cities, but the differences were not all that large. They've been growing ever since, and today we have one of the most uneven geographical maps in the history of America.
Uneven how?
Well, let me give you an example. In 1980, wages in Flint and in Austin were roughly the same. If anything, wages in Flint were a little bit higher. Today, wages in Flint are 50% higher for college graduates, and 80% higher for high school graduates. And it's not like the workers in Austin are better workers or work harder or longer hours. It's the entire ecosystem that surrounds those workers. It's the city ecosystem that is different. And in particular, the number of highly educated workers in that city.
You mentioned this in the book, and I'm just curious about how it happens. I mean, I know a lot of work goes into it because I've been following it for a long time, but you take a city like where we speak to you from in Albany, New York, and as you mentioned in the book, while few regions excel in many areas of high technology, America is dotted by clusters, and one of those clusters being in Albany in the sector of nanotech. How does that happen? What is it about this city, about this region, that allows that to happen? Because Austin would have wanted that, right? Flint would have wanted that.
Of course. If you look at the map of the high-tech clusters in America, you see two or three very large ones with very diverse set of industries. Obviously, the largest of all is Silicon Valley, that has IT, digital entertainment, clean tech, biotech, and some nanotech. Then there is places like Seattle or Austin that have like one or two or three of those technologies. But then you have a handful of smaller clusters, more specialized clusters, and Albany is a good example. There are many other examples. There is Provo Utah in IT. There is Dallas in telecom. So the map is scattered with more specialized clusters. And what's interesting is that these clusters, you know, the way they appear, it's often very random and serendipitous. It's rarely the case that the clusters are engineered by a deliberate policy, by policymakers. They often appear from the success of some company that then becomes the seed for the entire cluster.
And a lot of this gets into where we come from and our background as well. For example, you have a map in the book which identifies cities in which college-educated immigrants outnumber high school dropout immigrants by at least 25%, and cities in which the reverse is true: New Haven, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and New York are examples of destinations for high-skilled immigrants. Surprisingly, you write, this group also includes some former manufacturing hubs like Pittsburgh, Albany again, Buffalo, and Cleveland. So you get into a demographic issue as well, don't you?
Absolutely. There are enormous differences in the number of college graduates per capita across American cities. The cities at the top, like D.C., San Jose, or San Francisco, typically have five times more college graduates per capita than the cities at the bottom, cities like Flint or Merced, California. These differences are in large part driven by American residents, but they're made stronger by immigrant flows. Immigrants are in the U.S. are of basically two types: either very, very high skilled or very, very, very low skilled. So either you have people with college or master degree, or with the high school dropout. And the type of immigrants that cities attract is widely different depending on the type of their own residents. So cities that have a lot of college graduates tend to attract immigrants that are highly, highly skilled, that have at least a college degree, sometimes a master degree. Cities whose American residents are not all that educated tend to attract less educated immigrants. And this further exacerbates the difference across communities.
So with this information, Enrico, what do you think we should do with it? In the sense of, how does this help us in developing jobs in the future and making sure that we have a more active, creative workforce?
Well, that's the $1 trillion question. In today's economy, a company's success depends more than just the quality of its worker. It also depends on the entire ecosystem that surrounds it, and especially the average level of skill in the community. My research shows that cities that have many college-educated workers tend to attract innovative companies, and these innovative companies open up jobs for college graduates, and this further reinforces their edge. You know, as you see, it's a tipping point dynamic. By contrast, cities with few well-educated workers miss out on the growth of high-tech, and this further reduces their appeal. Now, you might say, well, this is all interesting if I work in high-tech, but, you know, the vast majority of people, the average American worker, will never work for Google or for Apple or for the latest biotech startup. Why does this matter for them? Well, it matters tremendously. The rise of innovation and high-tech as a driving force in our labor market matters not just for those who work in that sector, but also for all of us who don't work there. And the reason is that anytime you attract a company that is innovative, like an internet company, a biotech company, an high-tech company, that city gains more than just those employees in that company. It gains all the other jobs that are indirectly supported in the local service sectors, occupations like waiters, carpenters, doctors and teachers. And this effect is very large. My research suggests that for each new high-tech job in a city, five additional jobs are created outside high-tech in that city. So take Apple, for example. Apple employs 13,000 workers in Cupertino, but it generates almost 70,000 additional service jobs in the region.
Right.
For the waiters, the doctors, the taxi drivers, and the at all skill levels. So remarkably, Apple's main effect in the local economy is not among high-tech workers. It's outside high-tech. And so going back to your question, an important implication of this is that the best way for a city today to generate jobs for the least fortunate of its residents, the least skilled workers, is to attract innovative companies that hire highly skilled ones.
One of the things that you write about in the book, and you say one solution to unemployment in failing cities is for the federal government to help out-of-work residents to relocate to a more successful city with a relocation voucher that covers a portion of the moving expenses. While I understand why that would help the worker, what does it do for the city that they're leaving and the impact that it has on the waiters and the taxi drivers and the grocery clerks that you mentioned a moment ago?
Absolutely. So one, you know, just to give you some context, there are enormous differences in mobility rate across American workers. Some American workers, typically those with a college degree or more, are very, very mobile. They're very able to find information about better jobs in different cities and move. Other workers, like high school graduates and high school dropouts, have much lower mobility rates. They're much less able to find job opportunities in other labor markets. Even when they are living in a very, very weak labor market, they are reluctant to look for job opportunities somewhere else. Now, this is an average, of course. It doesn't apply to all individuals, but on average, that's true. And some of it reflects the lack of cash, the lack of upfront liquidity that is necessary to make a move. So if you are an unemployed and you don't have many resources, it's really hard to finance a move. And so my proposal is to make part of the unemployment insurance system relocation vouchers for those who would like to move, but they can't because they're trapped. This relocation voucher might help them to find to move to a city with a stronger labor market and find a better job.
But if fewer people are going, if that person then moves to another city, let's say Pittsburgh, and they go from Albany to Pittsburgh or Flint to Pittsburgh, and okay, you're in Flint, and that guy who used to come into your restaurant and that woman who used to pick up her dry cleaning at your store is now moved. So doesn't that have an impact that on their economy and will ultimately put that, I mean, you can't move everybody.
That's right. I think this is absolutely true. At the same time, if in Flint there were 1,000 workers looking for jobs and there were 100 jobs available, and now, say, 300 of those 1,000 unemployed workers have relocated to Pittsburgh thanks to the mobility voucher, now the probability that those who remain in Flint find those jobs is higher. So this scheme might help not just those who are trapped in Flint and would like to move, but they don't have the cash to move, but also those who decide to stay and now are facing less competition for a fixed number of jobs.
The name of the book, and it's fascinating, is The New Geography of Jobs. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Enrico Moretti, I thank you very much for sharing your research with us, and best of luck with the book and your future work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A great pleasure having you here. Again, the name of the book is The New Geography of Jobs. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.